Next case this morning is Noel Pharmaceutical against National Union Fire Insurance. Mr. Holden.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. I will be this morning addressing the duty to defend issues. My colleague, Ms. Kohlross, will be focusing on the damages issues. Either one of us is prepared to answer questions about either one, but I'm going to...
I should think so, since they largely turn on the same things.
Yes, we will. Either one can prepare, can respond to either questions, but that's what my focus is going to be. The trial court took what this court has accurately described as a fairly narrow clause and expanded it far beyond recognition. The advertising injury and personal injury clauses are narrow because, unlike coverage for bodily injury or property damage, they're built from the ground up by applying only to certain specified offenses. Those offenses do not include antitrust violations such as those alleged in the underlying suits against Noel. In fact, this court noted in the Curtis Universal case that insurance companies will not insure against liability for antitrust violations because such violations are impossible to predict by the actuarial methods on which insurance companies base their determination of premiums. Noel's broad reading of the policies is not a reasonable reading because it would lead to coverage for all kinds of unpredictable claims far beyond those that were intended to be covered. And as is well known, insurance is based on the theory of predictability. If an insurer cannot predict with some level of confidence how many claims and what kind of claims it's going to get, it has no choice but to quote higher premiums in order to cover the increased risk. There is one and only one exception to this rule that antitrust violations are not covered. As this court has put it, insurers do have a duty to defend against antitrust suits that also allege other common law business torts, to the extent that those torts are enumerated offenses under the policy. To meet that requirement, however, Illinois law requires that the complaint against the insured must allege all of the elements of a listed offense for there to be a duty to defend. In this case, the trial court ignored that rule. Instead, it held that since...
I have a lot of trouble with that line of argument. Illinois is a fact-pleading state.
Yes.
So one has to allege certain things in Illinois. Federal courts are not fact-pleading courts. And it seems to me part of your argument is an effort to smuggle fact-pleading principles into federal practice.
Well,
that can't be right.
It's not a question of whether the pleading is sufficient to meet federal pleading standards or state pleading standards. It's whether a claim is alleged that falls within the coverage of the policy. And virtually every court that's looked at it, including those in Illinois, have said that there has to be an allegation that alleges all the elements of the covered offense
Look, under Rule 8, you don't have to allege any elements of any offense. That's not how pleading works in federal court.
Yes.
So your argument seems to be that no insurer ever has a duty to defend because a good federal pleading will never allege the elements of the claim.
Well,
and therefore, there will never be any defense or, as your colleague will say, ever any coverage. That just can't be right. You must have some other line of argument.
Well, certainly the pleadings in this case were full of facts. There were dozens of pages of facts alleged in this case, and they were very specific about the facts that they were basing their claims on and what the rationale of their claim was. And the rationale of their claim was that somebody else had their products disparaged. Somebody else, perhaps, had been defamed, and they had to overpay for their prescription drugs, not because they were defamed or that anything disparaging was said about them, but that something was said about somebody else that indirectly led to them being defrauded and having to pay more for their drugs. And it's not a question of the pleading standard as to whether a cause of action was stated. Certainly, in their case, since they were saying causes of action for fraud and antitrust violation.
There's no such thing as a cause of action in federal court.
A claim.
That term was abolished in 1938,
yes.
Quite deliberately, in order to distinguish federal practice from state practice.
They did manage to state claims for antitrust violations and for fraud, Your Honor. They did not allege the elements of the torts. They didn't attempt to allege that those torts had been committed. They didn't attempt to recover for those torts. They didn't allege facts that would support those torts.
Would it have been different if the insurance policy said something like disparages the claimant's person or organization?
Well, certainly the policy could have been drafted differently than it was. That doesn't make the policy ambiguous as it's drafted. Every court that's looked at it across the country has held that this does not apply to claims that might be covered offenses against someone else, but are not covered offenses against the plaintiff. And just because the policy could have been drafted differently doesn't mean that it is ambiguous. The court has to take the policy language that is presented to it and determine what was the mutual intent of the parties in entering into that policy from the language in that policy, not compared to other policies that might or might not have been drafted. And in this case, the language refers specifically to a list of offenses that have to be, that damages have to be sought for those offenses in order for there to be coverage under the policy.
So if the person who is, I guess, disparaged, just to keep it simple, had filed suit, then there would be certainly a duty to defend.
Yes. If one of Noel's competitors had filed a lawsuit saying you have disparaged our product by your advertising, then there would be a duty to defend that lawsuit, assuming there weren't some other exclusion or something that applied. But generally speaking, yes, there would be a duty to defend that. Where a consumer says, I've had to overpay for this because you've misled me about the quality of your product by claiming that it's better than other people's product, that's not a claim for disparagement or defamation. It's not a claim for damages arising out of disparagement or defamation. It's a claim for damages arising out of monopolistic practices and fraud on the consumer. And that's what the Connecticut Supreme Court held in the QSP case, said even though arising out of is broad, and in fact they used essentially the same arising out of definition that Illinois courts use, even though arising out of is a broad term, it is not so broad that it can be read to change what the offenses are that have to be alleged. And so, since there was in that case, just as in this case, a claim that consumers had to overpay for the product they were purchasing from the plaintiff because the plaintiff had disparaged competitors, the court said that's not a disparagement claim or a defamation claim. It doesn't allege damages arising out of those offenses. A similar case in an analogous context in Illinois is the Diamond State versus Chester Jensen case, which was in the bodily injury context, in which the plaintiff was the owner of a building where the air conditioning failed, and some employees became ill, had to go home. The plaintiff sued for economic damages that it lost because of the air conditioning failing, including loss of productivity because its employees became ill and had to go home, and the insured argued that was a bodily injury claim. And the Illinois court said, no, it's not a bodily injury claim because you have to look at the nature of the claim that the plaintiff is making. The nature of the claim is for economic loss. It is not for bodily injury. They're not even seeking damages for their own employees' bodily injury. It's not like the employees sued them for bodily injury and then the employer sought to recover that from the insured. The only connection with bodily injury was a very tenuous connection that it indirectly led to the employer suffering economic damages. A similar situation here. The plaintiffs here suffered economic damages because they had to overpay for their prescription drugs. They were not defamed or disparaged. The only connection with defamation or disparagement is that they allege that some of the statements that Noel made that misled them also happened to defame or disparage someone else. That's not what is intended to be covered by this policy, and every court that's considered it is so held. Even this court, in looking at these issues as to what has to be alleged to find a covered offense, has said, I mentioned earlier that this court has said...
you know, what we've said, and $1.50 will, or these days maybe $4, will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. I mean, we're just playing ventriloquist dummy here. What we've said is a guess about what a state court will say.
That's correct.
What have the Illinois courts said, since that's what matters here? You've given up your argument that Louisiana law governs, I gather.
We never did contend that Louisiana law governs. I believe one or two of the other carriers may have contended that.
No one is arguing that.
No one is arguing that, that's right.
Let's talk about what Illinois cases have said.
The Illinois cases that have addressed this issue have said that all of the elements of a covered offense must be alleged.
No.
Now, I know you distinguished that.
That is going nowhere. Stop talking about alleging, and let's just see if we can match to the nature of the claims in the case. What has Illinois said about that?
What Illinois has said about that is in the Diamond State versus Chester Jensen case, if it's not a bodily injury, if it's not the plaintiff's bodily injury claim, it is not covered under bodily injury coverage. By analogy here, if it's not the plaintiff's claim for disparagement or defamation,
I'm not sure I understand
claim.
That either. And suppose you have a tort suit where there's a claim for loss of consortium, right? A is hit, B claims for loss of consortium. Any doubt that the insurer has to defend and indemnify the loss of consortium suits filed by B, even though B was never hit?
The loss of consortium cases have been distinguished by the cases looking at this issue, and they've said that in a loss of consortium case, the marital couple is held to have essentially the same cause of action or the same claim, and so it's held to be a bodily injury claim. But when it's not the unique situation of a marital couple, in fact, it was the QSP case addressed that and distinguished the loss of consortium claims on that basis. Where it's not a marital couple, the Illinois case law is that if the, as in the Chester Jensen, where an employer is suing because its employees suffered bodily injury, not because it's suing to recover for that bodily injury, but because it suffered damages because of that bodily injury, that is not a bodily injury claim. That's what the Illinois courts have said. And there's simply no other case that has gone the other way. Noel hasn't cited it. We haven't found it. That's what the Illinois courts have said. I don't see any distinction between that case and this one. You have to look at the nature of the
claim. The line you're drawing here with this, who is the plaintiff, suggests that there would be a difference for both coverage and indemnity. If Noel had, suppose what Noel does is Noel publishes an ad saying, you know, Warner Lambert's drug will kill you as soon as you take it, right? You're suggesting that there would be a difference according to whether the consumer bought the Warner Lambert drug or whether the consumer bought the Noel drug?
I'm suggesting there would be a difference if Noel was sued by Warner Lambert, then there would be defamation or disparagement covered. If the consumer sues, they're not suing for defamation or disparagement. It's not, the nature of the claim is not a defamation or disparagement claim, and it's not covered.
Well, why isn't it the consumer who tells you whether the nature of his claim is defamation or disparagement?
Because the Illinois courts have held that the duty to defend does not depend on the labels placed on the cause of action or claim in the pleading. It does not depend on the underlying plaintiff's characterization of the claim. It depends on the facts that are alleged.
Depends on what he's suing for.
I'm sorry?
Depends on what he's suing for.
Yes. And if they're suing for defamation or disparagement damages, then you're going to have a defamation or disparagement offense, and there's going to be potential coverage. If they're suing, as in this case, for having overpaid for drugs as the victim of an antitrust violation.
But now, as soon as you say it depends on what he's suing for, you've abandoned the theory that it depends on who the plaintiff is. What you're now saying is it depends on what the plaintiff's claims are. Now, that's more comprehensible, I think.
Yes, and the way I would tie those together is that in order to determine what the plaintiff's claims are, you have to look at who the plaintiff is, and a consumer...
No, just look at what his claims are. There may be a set of claims, right? Since you wanted to talk about coverage, if the plaintiff actually makes a claim based on product disparagement, but it turns out that because of who he is, he doesn't have a good claim, then there is a duty to defend, but not to indemnify.
If he's actually making a claim for product disparagement.
You're not taking the position, which has been rejected many times over, that there's no duty to defend whenever the plaintiff has a bad claim.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Where you get into looking at
who the plaintiff is may affect whether he's got a good claim or a bad claim, but it can't affect whether there's a duty to defend.
But in a situation where they're not purporting to state a claim for defamation or disparagement,
then it doesn't depend on who the plaintiff is, but on what the plaintiff's claim is.
Yes. And in this case, what the plaintiff's claim is not a defamation or disparagement
right.
claim.
That's more understandable.
Okay. I'll yield to Ms. Kohlroth for the remainder of our opening time.
All right. Ms. Kohlroth.
May it please the court, counsel, I want to address your question as to what Illinois case law states on this issue. The Lexmark case, which is cited in our brief.
The which case?
Lexmark. It's at 761 Northeast 2nd, 1214. Specifically sets forth the test for determining whether there is a duty to defend. It states that the underlying complaint allegations must raise a potential for liability under one of the offenses listed in the policies. That's what's missing here. Whether you look at who the plaintiff is, or you look at the facts that are alleged, or the nature of the claims asserted, what's missing is potential for liability under one of the offenses listed in the policies. And that test is set forth at page 1222 of the decision, which is a 2001 Illinois Appellate Court case. I do want to turn to the issue of the defense costs claimed and awarded in this case. The district court here awarded nearly $40 million in alleged defense costs based upon a single deposition from Knowles General Counsel and a single report from Deloitte & Touche indicating that the bills that Knowles tendered were actually paid by Knowles. This award cannot stand for all of the reasons set forth at length in the briefs of the parties. Today, I just wanted to focus on a few of the most compelling points. Foremost, the district court's award encompasses nearly $7 million in non-defense costs, costs which were not incurred by Knoll in defense of the underlying Synthroid litigation. These costs are set forth in a chart on page 33 of National Union's opening brief, and they include nearly $5 million for notice and administration of the class action settlement. This is an indemnity item that Knoll's own general counsel, Thomas Allman, admitted were only included as purported defense costs, quote, upon the advice of counsel, end quote. And it is our position that Knoll attempted to categorize these as defense costs merely to avoid the cap on liability damages under the policy limits, because here defense costs were not limited. Knoll has offered no justification for the inclusion of these multi-million dollar amounts in the district court's award. In fact, the issue of the payment for the settlement and administration costs is not even addressed in Knoll's brief, effectively conceding the court's error. Secondly, when one reviews the record, it's clear that the district court engaged in a rush to judgment. The court stated that its goal was to get the case before your honors as quickly as possible. It wanted to resolve the matter and get it before the Seventh Circuit. The insurer's requests for discovery were denied. The court ignored the contrary evidence offered by the insurers to controvert the fees claimed by Knoll. The Meckler report, which was submitted by the insurers, contains both detailed fact recitations controverting the alleged defense costs claimed, as well as expert opinions that these costs were not reasonable and were not incurred in total in defense of the Synthroid litigation. The district court's opinion doesn't even mention the Meckler report. The court also proceeded to resolve disputed fact issues, despite the fact that on summary judgment motion, any disputed fact issues would need to be resolved in favor of the non-movement and proceed to further resolution. The district court resolved every disputed fact issue in favor of Knoll, again, in a rush to judgment to get this case before the Seventh Circuit. I also do wish to note, it's discussed at length in our brief, the issue of which standard is to be applied in determining reasonableness. We submit to the court that whatever standard is applied, the district court's award cannot stand. It's untenable under the MedCon case, it's untenable under the Balcor case, it's untenable under the Illinois appellate cases that we've cited, the Kaiser case, the Roll Print case. It's untenable under any set of the facts viewed by this court or the case law cited in our briefs, federal or state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Carlisle.
You're welcome.
Mr. Martin.
May it please the court. I think Your Honor was correct in focusing on what law is going to control here. The insurers now have decided that Louisiana law does not control, that in fact it is Illinois law. and that therefore will provide the applicable standards. Those have been identified in various Illinois Supreme Court decisions, such as Outboard Marine, Employers Insurance of Wausau, and in Seventh Circuit decisions, such as Cincinnati Insurance Company v. Eastern Atlantic, Travelers Insurance v. Penda, and others. It's a long-established chain of decisions where basically the duty to defend is much broader than the duty to indemnify. The court is to compare the allegations on the underlying complaint with the policy language. If any allegation of fact falls within or potentially within the policy's coverage, this gives rise to a duty to defend. The allegations of the underlying complaint are to be construed liberally in favor of the insured. The complaint need not allege or use affirmative language bringing claims within the scope of the policy. What is important is not the legal label.
Well, suppose the question here is whether a claim that the price was too high for a product that worked as advertised is within this kind of policy, as opposed to a claim that says your product did not work as advertised. What is your best Illinois authority for the proposition that this policy covers a claim whose nub is the price was too high for a product that works as advertised?
For a price too high for a product that works as
advertised. Works as advertised. Since there's no allegation in the underlying suit that Synthroid didn't do exactly what Noel said it would do.
But I think what the allegations were...
Don't quibble with my question, right? I'm just searching for what state law says about that.
Could I have the question one more time, because I'm not
yes.
sure?
What would be your best authority in Illinois law for the proposition that a claim of the nature, the price is too high for a product that works as advertised, is covered by an advertising injury policy?
Just simply because the price is too high, nothing else.
For a product that works as advertised.
And works as advertised.
Yeah.
I don't have one at the top of my head.
But that was the basic claim in the underlying Synthroid litigation.
I think that...
Since there was no... The plaintiffs were not claiming that Synthroid didn't do exactly what Boots and Noel said Synthroid did.
I think they were taking some issue with that. Because I think what they were saying was that the reason they ended up purchasing Synthroid is because of representations and advertisements that it was more effective than other products, that it was superior than other products. And that's what led them to buy and therefore pay the higher price.
Well, no, that wasn't it that the other products weren't working, living up to what they said. I guess it just matter whether the glass is half full or half empty.
Put it differently, not bioequivalent, which is the claim Boots and Noel were making, is not a claim that the other product is inferior. It's just a claim that it's different.
Well, I think there were also allegations, and we identify them in the pleadings, where the underlying plaintiffs allege that Boots was saying its product was more effective and superior to the other products. And that necessarily is saying the other products are not as good. I guess there's a difference between saying, for example, I make a great car, which doesn't necessarily disparage other car makers. But if I say I make the best and safest mid-sized passenger sedan, better than and safer than the other mid-sized passenger sedans that are out there, that disparages the other.
No, it's not even actionable. That kind of claim is not actionable. It's covered by the standard puffing rule. In fact, it's so transparently non-actionable that suit would be dismissed as frivolous.
But I think, isn't it a little different where you're sitting here and talking about an FDA standard, and if you're talking about a government standard, for example, and taking the car example, where you're talking about crash tests on safety, and you're purporting that you're or advertising, and the allegation here is that the advertisements were not accurate, that your car is in fact safer. That's what the underlying plaintiffs were asserting, is that they received advertisement that said that Synthroid was superior, more effective than other products, and that the other products were not bioequivalent and did not work as well.
No. That's not the nature of a therefore in a claim based on bioequivalence. But I don't see any point in debating what the underlying suit said. And the reason I initiated this inquiry was to find out where Illinois law stands. And I understand your answer to be saying that you aren't even asserting that Illinois law would treat a claim of excess price for a product that works as advertised as covered by an advertising injury clause.
I don't know that the plaintiffs were asserting that it didn't work. I think, and I've got the allegations here, I think it's page 7-9, on page 4 of the statement of facts in our brief, defendants advertise that Synthroid is more effective than or superior to other drugs available to treat hypothyroidism. Also, BSF Noah and Boots use marketing and advertising designed to convince the public of Synthroid's greater effectiveness than other drugs available to treat hyperthyroidism. Then it went on to conclude, it made specific comparisons between Synthroid and Levoxyl as not being bioequivalent and providing the same effectiveness in terms of the treatment. And that's part of the reason that the underlying plaintiffs were claiming that they were forced to pay too much. Same one for the third-party payers, who basically said that but for this, they would have selected a less expensive product because they would not have believed that Synthroid, in fact, was superior and better and more effective than the other products, that they could have been substituted. What is important in Illinois law is not necessarily, as we said, the legal label that a plaintiff attaches to the defendant's conduct, but whether the conduct is at least arguably within one or more of the categories of wrongdoing. And it's not merely a plaintiff need not demonstrate or a falsehood or the probability of recovery, it's only the possibility. Other words that the Illinois court has emphasized is that the threshold that the complaint must satisfy to present a claim of potential coverage is low. All doubts and ambiguities must be resolved in favor of the insurer. If there are several theories of recovery, the duty to defend arises if even one theory of recovery is potentially covered under the policy, and that an insurer cannot escape from his duties of defense and indemnification by reference to the core or dominant character of the plaintiff's allegations. That would violate the principle that if any conduct alleged in the complaint falls within the scope of the insurance policy, the insurer must defend. So motion
to defend, they would have to defend then if the advertisement or whatever disparages any person or any organization's product.
I don't think it is. I think you still have to have the causation, and that's what the trial court focused on. You have to have a disparagement of a product, a service, or an organization that the party is relying on and is causing the damages. The damages have to be tied to it. That's why the arising out of and the but-for causation that the Illinois courts have repeatedly attached to the arising out of language is important here. There's a series of Illinois cases that say where you have arising out of the offense, that is the language that's in this policy, that is but-for causation and not necessarily proximate causation. Your Honor indicated earlier that there was an issue about the way the policy language is worded. It says advertising a personal injury arising out of one or more of the following offenses: oral or written publication of material that slanders or libels a person or organization or disparages a person or organization's goods, products, or services. What the carriers are asking for here is to have the word personal organization changed and have this court graft in the term plaintiff, so that it's oral written publication material that slanders or libels a plaintiff or disparages a plaintiff's goods, products, or services. I don't think that's what the policy says, and that's not the way it's worded. And certainly, in terms of Illinois law, they had controlled the policy. They understood that that's the way it's identified. And in fact, their sister carrier, Rural Insurance Company, when it first received the complaint, did an analysis, and it came to the same sort of an analysis as the district court. This is in the record at 1, Exhibit 12, and this was the response on August 27, 1997, when Royal was performing its contemporaneous analysis. And unlike this court's decision in Cincinnati Insurance Company v. Eastern, where it reiterated the rule that refusal to defend is unjustifiable unless it is clear from the face of the underlying complaint that the facts alleged do not fall potentially within the policy's coverage, this is what Royal said. It is unclear whether those claims constitute advertising injury, as that term is defined. In any event, it does appear that the injuries allegedly suffered occurred because of Boots' conduct after the expiration of Royal's policy in September of 1994. Thus, to the extent there is any advertising injury, that advertising injury would have resulted from an offense after Royal's policy, and the Royal policy thus would be inapplicable to those claims. So Royal itself was not disputing that there was a lack of authority as to whether their policy applied. They did not insist that there was any requirement that the plaintiff be the one disparaged, and it was not even disputing the existence of offense. At that point in time, they were simply saying that the offense, as they understood it with the early pleadings, was after their time period.
So they don't, it doesn't matter how it's interpreted as long as they don't cover it.
Well, I think the issue here is whether or not there's a reasonable interpretation. And if there are reasonable alternative interpretations, then the duty to defend exists and the carrier should have been defending. And the fact that another large commercial insurer viewed it that way and found that ambiguity is very, very salient here, very important. And it's certainly, the insurers, in order to avoid the duty to defend, must demonstrate that they have the only reasonable reading. So long as there's an alternative reasonable reading, the Illinois courts say that a court cannot choose, but it must adopt the reading that favors the policyholder, because insurance policies are purchased for the purpose of providing coverage, for covering the unexpected. We also provided in our submission to the court, Your Honors, a firm Chubb Group insurance policy that also addresses the issue where the carrier is suggesting who brings the claim makes the difference. In the Chubb policy, after the language we talked about, of oral or written publication of material that slanders or libels a person or organization, there's an exception, and the exception says, except when alleged, charged, or suffered by a customer. So if the carriers want to and recognize that they want to exclude coverage for a customer, they know how to accept that, and other carriers have done that. That form is filed with the Illinois Department of Insurance. That's used by Chubb in the CGL policy they use with financial institutions. When they decide there's an area where they're concerned about customers bringing claims, they know how to accept it. They know how to draft their policies to address that. And that, again, recognizes that there exists a reasonable reading, particularly with the use of the disjunctive, alleged, charged, or suffered, that you could, in fact, have allegations or claims that are alleged by a customer that aren't necessarily suffered by a customer, as well as those that are suffered by a customer but may be alleged by someone else. Different claimant. We also provided some background for your honors in the Moon article that we addressed, where it talks about the ISO history and the fact that these policies were again revised in 1998. There the author speaks about the fact that there's potential coverage for complex commercial litigation and laments that the carriers had an opportunity then where they were concerned about the broad open invitation under the defamation and disparagement coverage to address it. They could have provided revisions. And incidentally, the Chubb policy that we identified was filed with the Illinois Department of Insurance in 1995. So in 1998, if they wanted to exclude customers, for example, they knew how to do it and they could have done it and decided not to. Expand the coverage. This court in Cincinnati Insurance Company v. Eastern Atlantic indicated a duty to defend arose in the context of a tortious interference claim. Tortious interference also is not identified in the policy, but the means of interference that was used there were disparaging statements. And in fact, those disparaging statements were largely aimed at a non-party insurance agency called Shumaki. Another precedent that we think is very important here, although not involving advertising injury, is the Travelers Insurance Company v. Penda case. There, the insurers, with respect to property damage, said that there could not be a duty to defend unless the underlying plaintiff suing the policyholder actually suffered the property damage. This court said that it doesn't matter who owned the property or whether or not the underlying plaintiff owned the property. The policy covered property damage, and as a result, there was a possibility of coverage and a duty to defend. Just as here, there were disparaging statements alleged, allegations that that by saying that Synthroid was more effective and superior to other products, it was disparaging other products such as Levaxyl, and that was a cause of the injury that was suffered. The Illinois Appellate Court in Lexmark approvingly cited the trial court's decisions in a series of advertising and personal injury cases, Sun Electric, Winklevoss, and Noe, and said, quote, "We understand that a claim for relief is not essential to establish a duty to defend. Only the allegations in the complaint must fall within the covered provisions," and cited to Sun Electric for that proposition. The Illinois Appellate Court in Pekin recently decided, which we provided to your honors in a supplemental submission, says that as long as you have a statement about a competitor's goods or services that is untrue and misleading and must have been done to influence or tend to influence the public to not buy those goods and services, that gives rise to potential coverage and a duty to defend. There, the carrier also sought to graft an additional requirement, saying, well, this needs to be publicly distributed and widespread distribution. And the Illinois Appellate Court says the policy includes no such requirement for publication to the general public, and we will not add one. So here, where the insurers are arguing that you have to have all the elements of a particular cause of action, or you have to specifically have the plaintiff being the party disparaged, those are not found in the policy language. That's a requirement that they're asking this court to graft into the policy where it's not found. And the Illinois courts say that you ought not to be grafting an additional requirement not found into the policy. Moreover, appellate court has considered a relevant analysis and also cites to the Null decision, and that's the First Circuit decision in Open Software Foundation. It also indicated that the policies don't necessarily cover causes of actions. The terminology that they used was range of activities. It covers a range of activities and covers communicative harms, injuries that occur as a result of communication, which is what we have here. There, the court indicated that there was no duty to defend because the complaints attributed the plaintiff's injuries solely to purchasing decisions. And the court said there was that the allegations were of a buyer's cartel and that the complaints did not allege that any disparaging comments caused the injuries that were at issue there. Finally, citing the Royal Trial Court, the court said the causal connection between the insured's activities and the alleged injury is the salient factor in determining a duty to defend. And in fact, cited the portion of the trial court's decision where it indicated that QSP, that the carriers in this case were overstating the holding of QSP. Briefly, I'd like to address QSP. Not following it, QSP is not based on Illinois law. In that case, the Connecticut Supreme Court applying Connecticut law found and did an analysis which was a primary charge analysis. They indicated, the Connecticut Supreme Court, that the primary charge in the complaint was one of antitrust violation, and as a result, there was not going to be a duty to defend. Illinois courts do not adopt a primary charge type analysis. It, in essence, as we've discussed, if there's any factual allegation that possibly or potentially or arguably gives rise to coverage, then there is a duty to defend. In fact, the QSP court said that there was a need to prove fundamental elements of an underlying tort of defamation or product disparagement, and without demonstrating that all of those fundamental elements were there, that you could not have a duty to defend. And that runs and flies right in the face of Illinois law, and the trial court correctly said so. In terms of the Diamond State v. Jensen case that Mr. Holden made reference to, there the plaintiff was seeking recovery for lost work days. There were workers who went home who were perfectly healthy, as well as workers who went home not feeling well. And what the court said was the illness, the alleged bodily injury, had nothing to do with a basis for recovery. And therefore, it was irrelevant whether or not someone was sick or not, which is totally different from this case. And the closer analysis is the one by this court in the Travelers v. Pendant decision. I'd like to turn for a moment to the award of attorney's fees. The district court did not abuse its discretion in determining that those were commercially reasonable. As this court has held in Medcom and Balcor, the commercial reasonableness test is a test that's decided at a point in time when no paid these out-of-pocket expense. It had the understanding that it was its money that it was expending.
Were and all of these expenses incurred in the defense of the litigation?
Yes.
And how do we know that?
First, Deloitte and Touche went and did a verification to determine that they were done as part of the defense. All of the invoices were submitted to the insurers. They were given each and every one along with the checks paying them. As a result, if the insurers believe and you have if they believe that there is a factual dispute as to whether or not a particular expense was incurred in the defense, why did they not put that in front of the district court? It would have been that hard instead of talking in the abstract.
They say they did.
They did not put a single invoice in front of the district court. And in fact, they did not make a specific argument to the district court. There was a one-line submission that basically attached the Meckler report and did nothing to say to the trial court, this is a disputed fact issue. We believe that there's some issues. You hear here previously some assertion about certain costs not being defense costs. That was not presented and argued to the district court. There was no summary saying we have an issue. We believe this particular item or entry was not a defense cost. There's a generalized one-line submission, an attachment of this report, leaving the district court to try to figure out where and perhaps why there may be some dispute, scouring the record to look for a dispute that may or may not be there.
Are you saying any challenge then is waived?
Yes.
Because they're talking in terms of $7 million. I don't know, remember all what the details were, but $7 million that shouldn't have been charged as part of the defense, I guess.
They're asserting that, and they did not provide a submission to court saying, we contest $7 million that we believe were not defense costs. There's no opportunity for the trial court to address that.
What was in the report that was attached to it?
Which report?
It was attached to their submission, their one-line submission.
They provided a report from Mr. Meckler that contained his characterizations and categorizations. It was an advocacy piece, to be frank. Had some pie charts, and in many ways, it was not particularly helpful. Give you an example. The Meckler report talks about there being something on the akin to 937 legal billers, some humongous number. If, for example, an associate went and checked for a partner on a procedural issue and put in a quarter hour's worth of time to check that issue, that suddenly is a legal biller. But the other thing that's sort of, I think, a sleight of hand here is if you had gone and taken someone from an internal litigation support, and that person was involved with, for example, putting documents onto a CD disk to be produced, that person's time if charged, which would be charged as an hourly basis, would be then compiled as a legal biller. And so they create these numbers and these categorizations and these assumptions that in no way assist the trier of fact in understanding if they really believed that there was an invoice or an issue that presented a problem. If they thought that this was absurd or obvious, why didn't they put it in front of the trial court and say, look, you can look at this for yourself.
It sounds like what you're now saying is that they did make their argument in the trial court, just not in a way that convinced you. But it's fairly common for advocates to fail to convince the other side. That doesn't equal waiver or forfeiture.
Well, I think part of it is putting a specific issue before the court so it could consider it. And some of the arguments that they're now making here, it would have been nice to have had those put forward so they also could be responded to. I'd like to address the last portion of our claim, which is a Section 155 claim against Travelers. With respect to that, Travelers took on the order of 17 months to provide any kind of a response to NOAA, other than an initial acknowledgement that it received submissions. And what, in essence, if you read Travelers' AIC, Automobile, what in essence you see from Travelers is they're saying that because subsequent to that time period, a case came down, such as QSP, and in their submission in that section, they say there are really only two cases that specifically address this issue, the trial court and QSP. It's a novel issue. You can have differences between the parties, and as a result, there's a bona fide dispute, and therefore, Travelers could not have been vexatious and unreasonable. But that doesn't explain reliance on a case that comes out after a 17-month period in which you've taken no action. You cannot subsequently rely on something that happens much later and say that you weren't acting vexatiously and unreasonably. In conclusion, we respectfully request that the trial court's decision on the duty to defend be affirmed. That also with respect, and it's not been argued here, but the succession to the policies by the statutory merger, which as I discussed in the brief, that case law is uniform, and the award of damages with interest. And we only take issue with the failure to find Travelers vexatious and unreasonable. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Morton. Anything further, Ms. Cole-Ross?
Exceedingly briefly. Your Honors, Royal is not before this court, and therefore any representations regarding the position it took in the litigation below are irrelevant and certainly not binding on the insurers currently before the court. I do want to take issue with the misrepresentation of the record as to what was before the district court on the reasonableness of defense costs. The excerpts from our memorandum in opposition to the summary judgment are quoted at page 18 of our reply brief. We also specifically refer to the Meckler report in support of our denials of the facts alleged by Knoll, including that these defense costs were reasonably incurred in the defense of the underlying Synthroid litigation. And finally, as far as the duty to defend is concerned, Knoll has conceded there is no Illinois authority supporting a claim for advertising injury coverage for the underlying litigation. We've cited numerous authorities from Illinois and outside that recognize there is no advertising injury coverage for these type allegations, and we don't need to belabor the point further. Thank you, Your Honor.
Question for information. There was no thought of a declaratory judgment action in these claims earlier.
There was no initial declaratory judgment action. That's correct. The action brought by Knoll was the first action. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear oral argument now.